when the tape ended, we were talking about Walter Adams' interim presidency, and you mentioned you met with Don Stevens, who was chairman of the board, board of trustees at MSU at that time. And what was his?
Well, Don wanted to have lunch because I just came back from Pakistan, and mm-hmm. I'd been overseas, and I knew Stevens. I knew a lot of the, not the inner circles of the Democratic Party, but a lot of the trustees. The trustees had been active supporters of the international program. And I had traveled with, I don't remember with whom I had traveled in the 60s, but before I went to Pakistan. But I knew them from one presentation or another. And Don wanted to, they were moving on the decision of the presidency. And I did not get the impression in that lunch that Stevens was going to push Walter. And that afternoon, Walter had a press conference in which he made it clear that he did not want the presidency. He'd mm-hmm. been saying that all along. And at the press conference, he reiterated that again. Well, I sort of interpreted that to mean that he wasn't going to get it. And this was his calculation, and he sincerely did not want it to begin with. He may have been tempted, but now this was the moment to make it clear that he was withdrawing from any interest. And then they made the appointment of Cliff Wharton. And Stevens had asked me about Cliff when we had lunch. And Cliff, I knew Cliff from his Rockefeller fund days and from his general work in the international development field. Cliff was a professional in this field, a very strong professional. Mm-hmm. So when they turned to Wharton, I was not surprised.
Did you have contacts with Dr. Wharton in professional conferences or anything like that?
Well, before he went out to survey a program for the council that he was being pulled into, the Agricultural Development Council, I think, or ADC, I think it was called then. Before that, he was sent on a visit to some of the major agricultural development universities in this country and to appraise how he could be a useful person. And he came, and we were still in the library at that point, the upper floor of the library. And I remember then we had lunch together, and Cliff was asking all kinds of questions about how he might be able to fit well into the Asian program of the ADC, or what their program ought to be. And Larry Witt, who was an active internationalist in ag economics in those days and became a close ally of our international program development, a major figure. Larry knew Cliff very well from economist days. And he was talking with Larry, he was talking with me and with Glenn Taggart and others. So by the time, let's see, that must have been in 1957.
That early?
It was either 57 or 1960. The reason I'm hesitant about the date, because I remember we were in the library building, it was 57, because he came on a tour of Asia then afterwards to see where he might locate and where the ADC program might be built. Mm-hmm. See, ADC was Rockefeller money. And he came to, when he came through Vietnam then the second time, he wrote to me, and we had a group together for Cliff, and he was, we had lunch, and he met John Dorsey, and he met our other Michigan State people. And he knew what we were doing in Vietnam, knew our work very well. And he was active in Southeast Asia himself, personally, professionally. So by the time I came back in the early 59, Cliff was already established. And then he was out in Malaysia, where he was based and where he was sending trainees to the United States. So I knew his work. Is this right?
It's fine. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I knew his work. I knew him personally. I met his Art Mosher, who was his mentor at the ADC, was president of the ADC, and a very strong international ag figure. Mosher told me, even before I learned from any other source, that Cliff was a serious contender for the presidency at Michigan State. And he said, I keep telling Cliff he should not take a presidency at this stage. He's still too young, you know, this kind of discussion. And we were lucky to get him because he had other options open all the time.
So when he came to campus then as president...
When he came as president, we met and we talked about how we could do this together. You know, he wanted the university to be what it was, moving toward being a national leader and internationalizing its program.
Were you optimistic about his appointment in terms of how it not you personally, but how it affected his attitude toward international programs?
I was very, very enthusiastic when he came, and had a good reason to be. I knew he knew as much about the field as any of us and would have things to do that would contribute. Good example, I took the group of Brazilians that came through, high-ranking Brazilian educators, to see Cliff Wharton. We walk in the door, and Cliff starts talking to them in Brazilian Portuguese. And it wasn't just a matter of politeness. I mean, they talked serious business. And Cliff did that on a number of occasions when we had people coming in the university. He never went out inspected what we did. I mean, he didn't take advantage of that opportunity, whereas the other presidents did when I worked with Cecil and when I worked with John DiBiagio, even John Hanna. Mm-hmm. They would get out there and see our projects. But to Cliff, that was always peripheral. He knew what was going on. Mm-hmm. He'd ask me.
He'd been around the country, around the world.
Yeah, if he had some problem, he'd ask me about it. And Cliff he went out for other reasons. He'd be invited out to Malaysia or whatever. And while he was there, he'd stop by a Michigan State activity here or there. I'm trying to remember. I think the Rockefeller Foundation board, I don't remember if he was on the board at that time or not, but they had a meeting scheduled out in Asia, so he took in several Asia projects in connection with that. Mm-hmm. That's how he got into it. But his being there, it added to our glow as a university on the international scene.
Mm-hmm. After his appointment, were there any ties strengthened at the university or programs that the Rockefeller Foundation had been able to support? Or
no,
he didn't push it or anything?
Well, in the case of Brazil, it mm-hmm. ended up with a very large technical assistance project because mm-hmm. when they met Cliff, they knew that whatever we did with them in Brazil would be watched over with great care. Mm-hmm. So we would not have had, we were competing against Ohio State, against Illinois, against Wisconsin, whole bunch of universities that these group of Brazilians had visited. And they, within 2 days, they elected Michigan State. After they got back to Brazil, they met and they called me on the phone and said, we want to go with Michigan State. And we haggled over details and that was it. And Cliff was undoubtedly the reason why we stood out above the others. And he followed the project pretty closely. Each of the presidents have been supportive in a different way. Cecil Mackey was the momentum that got us into China.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, so when Cecil, my own, let's see, I was in Washington, I think. I had taken an appointment on an IPA arrangement. And when Cecil came on board as president, and we talked on the phone, I in Washington and he wherever he was at the time, maybe in East Lansing. And then when I got back to the campus, I returned to the campus to get back into the dean's office. Warren Cohn, who was then our Asia Studies Center director, told me how interested Cecil was in China, and he was rightfully so, because China was the great landmass and great population and great culture and great history, and a university of any size or importance has to have people who know China, otherwise our classrooms would be weaker. So Cecil kept talking with Warren before I got back, and then shortly after I got back, this was all in the late 70s, Warren became the sort of the director of the state office dealing with China, as well as our own Michigan State leader. And Cecil wanted to put together a team, asked us to put together a team of Michigan State leading faculty people and a few of the deans to go to China. And we had invitations for that kind of a visit. So I put together a team with Cecil's agreement, including Dean Anderson of Agriculture, Dean Hollingsworth of Arts and Letters, who was studying Chinese at the time, and Sylvan Whitwer, who was head of the Ag Experiment Station, and three or four others of equal leadership roles. And we went over to, we had everything lined up. Warren had done an excellent job of scheduling things with colleagues that he already had in China, and with Chester Tsai, who was back in China at the time, I think. And we went in 1980. We were supposed to be there arriving early September. And on the way, I represented the university at the International Association of Universities meetings in the Philippines. And then we flew over to Thailand, Lil and I, and she was with me because of the IAU meetings, and then because I wanted her to come to China. There were several wives that were going to be in China. And she got into an accident in Thailand, which was terrible, and I had to leave her behind after her surgery, and assurances that she would be all right. But we went on, I went on and met the group in Beijing a day late, just before they were getting started in their official routine. And we went to four or five different locations and came back to Cecil eventually back in East Lansing and assured him that these were places we ought to associate with. They were good universities. And Cecil put his stamp of approval on it, and we proceeded. So he was really he moved us along a year or two, and he always paid special attention to the China program. He was also supportive in other respects, but that was his special brand. And John DiBiagio was sort of international by orientation. I mean, he just was plain interested in what we were doing. He was never a great development person, as Cliff was. He didn't have one particular hobby horse, as Cecil did. I don't want to limit Cecil by saying he had a hobby horse. He followed everything. But John just plain took a strong interest. For example, he came out to the meetings in 1985, a matter of weeks after he was appointed president. He came out to the UCLA campus where the International Association of Universities was having its once every 5-year meeting. That's the meeting I attended in the Philippines 5 years earlier in 1980. And John came out and established himself within the larger circle of university rectors and presidents from all over the world. And then later in Helsinki in 1990, he was brought into the leadership cadre within the IAU, one of the backup representatives. University of Pennsylvania president was involved heavily. For reasons best known to others, not to me, it was a very prestigious organization. It was made up of hundreds of major universities from around the world. And John was in the lead role in that group. He made a serious statement, a serious speech to the group. And then on campus, in many ways, he was supportive. Not in the same way as the others, but supportive. If there was anything we wanted him to do, he would ask us, and we would suggest things to him, and he would do them. That's the kind of president you want.
Was he supportive both of international programs and study abroad?
International development was important to him. He could see the difference we were making in various institutions. And study abroad, he was happy with that. I don't remember that as one of his specialties, as it is with Peter. And he had receptions at Cole's house for international students, things like that. And within Musea, the presidents were always brought into the Musea Council. You know. When we organized Musea way back in the early years, there were only four universities. And we were one of the four.
Are there schools other than Big Ten schools in that?
Just four, the four Big Ten schools.
Okay.
Gradually, over the years, not with any enthusiasm from we original four, it began to get too big. 5, 6, 7, okay. But when you get up to 10 and 11, it becomes a conference. And the intimacy began to evaporate. I was never in it when it had 10. Mm-hmm. I was in it from the very beginning, but by 1991, when I left for my position in Washington, it had only grown to about 7, I think. And it had changed in nature. I think it was, from my vantage point, it was losing its zest. It was beginning to be viewed as a foundation instead of a technical assistance operation. That may be too harsh, but I think it's accurate. I think history has borne it out. I got into big hassles in the board meetings because I kept trying to keep it a different kind of organization than I'd seen so many others become, namely, we didn't have to have a cast of thousands. We needed a cast of hundreds. You know, that was, size meant very little. If we had, when you have four major universities, as we did, that's pretty large. Mm-hmm. And I saw what was happening. The CIC could never go anywhere because it was, in my judgment, in the international arena because it was just too big. It was the whole Big Ten plus Chicago. And they kept trying to figure out what they could do internationally. And they finally got to organizing some study abroad programs. But they could never take on anything of direct importance. Mm-hmm. So now I guess Musea is probably the CIC international wing.
Are there any aspects that you're particularly proud of the developments of international programs and relations that you developed under your deanship that
well,
you can point to?
I would say that some of the projects that were taken on in agriculture were very successful. The work we did in Brazil was very successful, both in business and in the broader agriculture and management side that we got into in the late 80s. I would say that those are specific, and I could go on with four or five others, but I think the work that we did in Thailand in the field of education was important. I think that our work in Pakistan at Comilla was outstanding. And in fact, I devote a whole chapter to that subject in my book because it brought us in touch with Akhtar Hamid Khan, who is an outstanding rural development and administrator in the Pakistan setting. And he taught us a lot along the way. So I think our work at Comilla, you can say, was one of the outstanding things. I don't think my general observation on technical assistance work and on the university's contribution is that as we went along and learned more and more about how to do things, we learned just how complicated and how slow-moving some of these processes are. And therefore, I would say that from my vantage point, I began to understand the limitations of what a university can do in the international field. I put some of that in the book, too. But, I would say my position as a leader in international programs for those 35 years was to, the thing I would be most proud of would be the lead role that the university came into in the U.S. setting when it came to things international. We were not a Princeton or a Harvard where we were producing the ambassador of 20 years. We never had a school that could do that. Mm-hmm. Public policy was not our thing at Michigan. I tried to push that as I was pulling out of the deanship and as McPherson was reviewing what the university should do and might do. I tried to make the pitch that we needed a school of public and international affairs, a graduate school, and we began to produce Michigan State types of ambassadors instead of the starched shirts that I had met over the years. And a few Michigan Staters in that mix would make a substantial difference over the years. And not that I don't admire some of the, I met some outstanding ambassadors, mm-hmm. many of them over the years, had some good friends who were ambassadors. But Michigan State students and graduates are different than those coming out of Harvard and Yale and Princeton. And SIS down here at Johns Hopkins, and we had a lot to contribute. And I think the John Hanna Fellows and maybe eventually the Peter McPherson Fellows and professors and all of these would have made a hell of a good mix for turning out the generation of statesmen of this century. But I was never sufficiently persuasive. And I didn't have $1 million to put in, or $5 million to put into it either. So, mm-hmm. In any case, I would say that would be one of the disappointments I had. And it only came to me in the last few years just how active we could be in that direction. I put it in writing, and failed to get it taken seriously. But the thing that I took the greatest pride in that I'm. Think that the university can take pride in is that we did become the university that one could not be without if one were planning some new international education venture or some new international development venture. And I can illustrate that with statistics, but it can be illustrated by the some of the conferences we held in the later years also, some of the materials that were written. Or what was said about us by the people that took a look, always very high ranking. Dave Wiley, outstanding director of our African Studies Center, and who was and still is the outstanding expert on Title VI support, found about the last year or so that I was there before pulling out of the deanship, found that the foundations were putting together a major fellowship program to support graduate work in Africa and in other areas of the world under the area study umbrella. We needed PhDs in history who also had a serious African commitment, that kind of thing. And David's people had been very competitive under Title VI, and we had many graduate students going through under Title VI. But this new program, which was going to make, I think at the outset, 15 to 25 significant awards to graduate work, and then go from there, larger numbers, had defined area studies in such a way that we did not fit into the top eligible universities, which was incredible. But if you take the graduates of the Indiana University Africa Center and Johns Hopkins University and some of the others, and they define it entirely in terms of arts and letters, in terms of history, with all respect to historians, and political science and my own field and a few. They don't deal with the broader problem orientation of an area, nor do they deal with the broader definition of what makes a person expert on an area. And David had been toying with these concepts for years, and put together a strong paper, which I joined him in by reviewing it and commenting as dean. And he sent it in to the foundations and said, this is something you have to take into consideration. And it was. They opened the door to Michigan State. And Michigan State has put through more students as foundation-supported fellows under this program I'm referring to than any other university in the last decade. David filled me in on this last time I saw him. So I think that what we had going at Michigan State was outstanding in four or five different directions. And nothing happened in this country in the international education sphere without Michigan State being involved. Now, I'm not sure how many fields you can say that about coming out of our great university, but out of Michigan State. I know you can say that when it comes to certain fields in the natural sciences. I know you can say it in certain fields in agriculture. All of these things drawn fairly narrowly. But when you talk about the university as a whole becoming international, that concept became a model, and the way we went about it became a model for university after university. If you look at Peter McGraw's speech at the time John DiBiagio was being inaugurated into the university, Peter McGraw was then chairman. He was president of the University of Missouri, but he was chairman of the Land-Grant Association International Division Committee or whatever it was. And he was president of Land-Grant that year, president of the whole association. He came out and gave the speech in behalf of higher education at the time of John DiBiagio's big celebration. It must have been 85, fall of 85. And he, to my surprise, and I hadn't even coached him on it, he said precisely what I'm saying, namely that this university is the model in the international arena for development and related activity and service particularly, but he singled it out and said it. And it was good to hear.
The connection between the Land-Grant philosophy and international relations.
Yeah.
What do you see as that connection? And maybe talk a little bit about Hanna's, John Hanna's,
Hanna's
view of it. Was that different in terms of how you view it?
Hanna, when he initially set up the Office of International Programs, the Office of the Dean of International Programs, clearly wanted it to help people in the poor countries of the world. If you take Truman's Point 4 and read it carefully, Truman lays out a broad agenda for this country and the developing countries. He says that we will attack the villains of humanity, poverty, illiteracy, and so forth, and we will overcome them as a country. We will help. We will provide technical help and so forth. And that's where the universities fit in under that definition. But Hanna took that very seriously, and he was the president of Land-Grant Association in those days, and he wrote the initial letter in behalf of all of higher education to tell the president that we were behind him as universities. And then he came on the campus itself. He began things, set things in motion. He had been on a study commission, Rockefeller Commission, dealing with these subjects before. He knew them himself. He knew them well. And when he set up the International Program Office, he did not set it up to become also the builder of the international dimension in our academic programs. I believe it's fair to say that he was concerned with our relationships abroad and with what we could do to help those poor countries out there, as he would have put it. But when it came to feeding that back into our own programs, he was on uncertain ground. And Taggart is the one who conceptualized it in that way. And Hanna grabbed it. But Taggart had to bring it to him. And John Hanna was the kind of a thinker who could see the importance of the concept. And he carried it from there. So that he never in any way diminished the other side of the coin. The crunch came, and Taggart and I went to Jake Neville, who was then the provost of the university, and talked with Jake about the fact that we as a university had to evolve a strong international studies dimension, that we couldn't just extend ourselves overseas, and that our Ford Foundation money had enabled us to do that. Momentum was there. We had to keep it going. We need to institutionalize it. And we need money from the university budget for Asia studies, Africa studies, and so forth. I don't know if we said Africa studies in those days, because this this may have been before Africa was open to us. But we did say that to Jake, and Jake reached into his drawer and pulled out the budget. How much do you want?
writing the check.
And Hannah confirmed it, of course. Mm-hmm. So you can see that he picked up the concept of building the university in Boulder. And then it's Hannah who said, you have to have a building. Mm-hmm. Glenn didn't want a building. But Hannah wanted us to have a building. And Glenn told me one day, he said, you know, Hannah feels that he was a builder, you know, Hannah. Mm-hmm. He said, if you don't have a building, you're not permanent on this campus. You'll get wiped out by something 10 years from now, 5 years. I want to make you permanent. You're going to have a building. Mm-hmm.
Which now is in the center of campus.
Yes, begin with, it was going to be a wing of the first drawings that Hannah had generated, put us as a